We have been picking up on some phrases in verse 8, particularly there at the beginning of the verse, a little space, you'll find that. And then at the end of the verse, you'll find the words, a little reviving. A little space and a little reviving. I suppose maybe we could put in between those two phrases, much grace, because grace is mentioned there in verse 8, and it's not a little grace by any means, it's great grace. Verse 9 talks about extended mercy that the Lord has bestowed upon them. So if we think about little space and a little reviving, we certainly could put in between there much grace. And Ezra is thinking about what has happened in his own lifetime, and particularly his own return to Jerusalem, to the land of Israel. That's what he's referring to when he speaks about this little space of grace and this little reviving. He's speaking about what has been happening and how he's broken, so broken then over really maybe the misuse of this little space, because of what we read there in the early part of the chapter, how the people were not separating themselves from the people of the land, but were taking their daughters unto their sons and giving their daughters unto the sons of the ungodly. And this has broken Ezra's heart, and he comes to the Lord in prayer. But as he prays at the start of his prayer here, he's acknowledging that the Lord indeed, for a little space in the whole scheme of things and plan that he's working out, and even their existence, the Israelites' existence, that is, under the hand of these Persian kings, the Lord has given them a little window of reviving. And that's what we have been picking up on here and thinking about. You'll see there about a remnant that has escaped in verse 8. That's referring to the very small group of people who came back with Ezra. There were 50,000 or so came back with Zerubbabel almost 60 years earlier. There's only a couple of thousand that came back with Ezra, a very small number, just a little remnant, as he mentions there and uses the term. They have escaped from the land of captivity, and they're back in the land, and it seems as if, in Ezra's view, they're wasting this golden opportunity that has been presented to them. Now, we have been considering a few things around the subject of revival. We thought about that in the darkest days, God can give little seasons of refreshing and little seasons of revival. We also thought last time that God sends revival for the encouragement of his people. And we were picking up on that phrase there in verse 8, that our God may lighten our eyes. And there's the thought there presented to us of what revival does, God lightening our eyes. And even in this, it's in Nehemiah 6, a type of phrase is used, but it's used with the enemy, and how they were cast down of their eyes when they saw that Nehemiah had come to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And isn't it chapter Nehemiah 6 and 16? My memory serves me right from last week. And it came to pass that when all the enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. And that's what we want to happen. We want the enemy to be cast down rather than to be triumphant and rejoicing because they think they're on the up. We want the situation reversed around so that God's people, their eye is lightened. The heaviness and the weariness is taken away from the eye of God's people, and there God has lightened their eye. So the Lord sends revival to encourage his people. What I want this evening to do is to pick up on another phrase there in verse 8, and you'll see the words almost right in the very center of this verse, to give us a meal in his holy place. To give us a meal in his holy place. The Lord here is giving this remnant a little reviving so that they might gain a foothold in the land of Israel once again. Just to gain a little foothold in the land. They have lost the land. They have lost the temple. They have gone back, and the temple has been rebuilt. It started off and then was left off for many years, and then Zechariah and Haggai came ministering and stirred up the people, and it was finished. But there wasn't really a setting up of the proper worship of the temple. And we'll come to pick up on some of these things hopefully this evening, because they're mentioned in verse 9 here of some of the things as to really Ezra's definition of reviving. Because you'll see part of the way down verse 9, it says there to give us a reviving, and then it goes on to elaborate upon that, to set up the house of our God, to repair the desolations thereof, and to give us a wall in Judah and in Jerusalem. And we'll come to think about those terms. But Ezra is defining really what he understands this little reviving to be. And it's centered on the house of God, because that's where the desolations were. What is happening in this chapter is now an added thing, that the people were not separating themselves in their lives. But initially, Ezra, that's what brought him back initially from the land of captivity. The house was built. The temple had been built and finished. We read of that in Zechariah, where Zechariah spoke about even the capstone being put on the work of the temple. So the building, the physical building, was rebuilt, but there never was a proper setting up of the worship of the house. And that's what Ezra has gone back now to do and to bring about. And here he's describing it in verse 8 in this phrase, to give us a kneel in his holy place. Now we know that the holy place in Scripture is a reference to the temple, and particularly to the sanctuary in there. There's the holy place, and then there's the holiest of all, beyond the veil where the Ark of the Covenant was. So we automatically know what the holy place is referring to. That Ezra has his eye here and his thought upon the temple and what's taking place in the temple. And he thinks of what the Lord has just done in his lifetime. And he says, Lord, you've brought us back and you've given us this little reviving that we might get a foothold again. That we might get back to God's house and see it set up as it ought to be. And it's described here as a kneel in the holy place. That is a phrase that is a little familiar. There's a number of places where that terminology is used. For example, Isaiah 22. If you turn there for a moment, it's verse 23 of that chapter. Isaiah chapter 22 and verse 23. It's speaking about an individual that the Lord will give. And I think here, ultimately, it's the Messiah that is in view. But we're just going to pick up here on the verse. It's Isaiah 22, verse 23. I will fasten him as a nail in a sure place, and he shall be for a glorious throne to his father's house. So there's the nail in the sure place that is mentioned again. And in Zechariah 10, verse 4, is another place where this phrase appears. It says, out of him came forth the corner, out of him the nail, out of him the battle bow, out of him every oppressor together. So there's a number of mentions in the Old Testament here about a nail, and twice over there it speaks about the nail in a sure place, or a nail in the holy place, as it is here in Ezra chapter 9. Well, the obvious picture is the nail is used to join two pieces of wood together. And God had granted this little season of grace so that this remnant might get back to Israel, get back to Jerusalem, even get back to a connection with the temple and with the holy place. That's what Ezra's thinking about. Lord, you've given us this little reviving. Now, this kneel in the holy place, you've brought us back to your house. The land is a holy land as well. It maybe could well be widened out to think about the Holy Land in general. That's a title for the land of Israel. They were to be a holy people in a holy land. So Ezra may even be thinking about it in a wider context, about the land generally. They're back in the land, this little remnant. Some of them maybe have never seen the land of Israel. Born in captivity, have lived in these distant lands for their lifetime up until this point, when now they've come back to the land of Israel. They may never have seen the land, but now they're back in the land, they're back to the temple, they have the opportunity of being in the house of God, they have the opportunity of reforming the worship that goes on in this house so that it was pleasing to God. So Ezra is thankful to the Lord that the Lord has done this. And when the Lord comes and revives, it is connected with his house in whatever day. God begins to revive, he begins among his people. And he's going to begin it in his house. It's going to be seen in his house. It's going to manifest itself in his house, among his people. If revival comes, we can read revival and pick up on those points. You know as well as I do, if we go back to the 1859 revival that's so familiar to us, there's a number of Presbyterian churches in this land that were revival churches. They were built as a result of the revival because of the turning up at the house of God by people who had never been in it before, who had forsaken it and forgotten it and left it aside and didn't attend it. But such was revival and the moving of God that there were churches. The one that comes to mind is Second Brashean, is certainly one of the revival churches. But there's a number of other Presbyterian churches that were started at the time of the revival and connected. That's how they come into existence, that the existing congregation in a locality split in two and another church was started to accommodate the people who were coming. And there's a number of places where there's Second Presbyterian churches in towns and even villages. And I don't know whether all of them are connected with the revival or not, but certainly some of them are. When God begins to work, it's connected with his house. There's always this connection with his house. And that brings us then to think of what Ezra has to say here in verse 9 of this chapter. Because in his prayer, he goes on in verse 9, "For we were bondmen, yet our God hath not forsaken us in our bondage, but hath extended mercy unto us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us a reviving." And then he breaks it down like this: "To set up the house of our God, and to repair the desolations thereof, and to give us a wall in Judah and in Jerusalem." So there's three things here that he breaks it down into. The house of God was set up. Now, as I've already said, the temple was built. You can go back to chapter 6 there, and verses 14 and 15, and tells you that it's built. So he's not referring to the actual physical building of it when he's speaking about the house of God being set up. He's thinking about it in another way. He's thinking about the worship of God being set up properly. It's going to be regulated as God has ordered in his word. And that word, to set up, in Ezra 9 and verse 9, it has the meaning to exalt or to come to prominence. And maybe that draws out the meaning then of what it is. God's house is going to be raised up in their respect and in their esteem for this place. And is that not one thing that we lament in our land today? There's little regard for the house of God. There's been a forsaking of the house of God. There's a whole generation that, maybe more than one generation, that has grown up, and some of them has never darkened the door of a church. Seldom ever. Or if they do, it's only on a very rare occasion. Must have been back before Christmas when we were giving out leaflets. I was doing somewhat day round Carwood. And a painter, got talking to a painter, he was out of the front door as I was leaving in the leaflet, and he lives over in Elmwood Cottages. That's what started the conversation, because he saw the leaflet and he says, "I got one of those there on Saturday." And if you remember the Saturday that we gave them out. So I started chatting to him and I said to him, "Well, do you ever go to church?" And he goes, "No. Christmas and Easter will do me." That was his answer. "Christmas and Easter will do me." Twice in a year, he darkens the door of a church. And how many are like him? They seldom ever enter into the house of God. They have no regard for it. Don't think it important. But if God sends a little reviving, men and women, there's going to be the lifting up of God's house. The esteem for God's house is going to increase. There's going to be this coming to prominence again of God's house. Even among Christians, there's this idea that is developing about house churches. And that you can absent yourself from God's house and regular worship, and that somehow you can meet in homes and carry on some kind of a religious worship. It's true that the New Testament church started in people's homes, but there was a form that they followed. And I've said before that Ezra really is the start of that. In the preaching of the Word of God and the reading of Scripture that is found in Ezra's life, it's mentioned in Nehemiah particularly, because him and Nehemiah come together later on, and they gather the people come out actually into the street, there were so many of them, and Ezra reads, he gets up into the pulpit, we've looked at those verses, and he read the Scriptures, and then he gave the sense, he preached on it. And that's the New Testament pattern. There's a brand of evangelical religion, never mind those who are ungodly and have no time for church at all. There's a brand of evangelical religion, and it has forgotten the house of God. And it's not right. That is not of God. It is contrary to the pattern that is laid down for us in the Scriptures. And if God comes in revival, blessing, there's going to be a re-evaluating of the importance of God's house. It's going to raise in people's esteem and estimation. That's what it says here with regards to what Ezra did. And then it speaks about the desolations thereof being repaired. The worship of God had fallen into disrepair. As I said now a number of times, this is what brings Ezra back from captivity. It's not the physical building in disrepair, because that has been remedied. It's the fact that the worship that goes on in this temple is in disrepair. It's not honouring to God at all. Ezra and Nehemiah later on as well, these two men are going to be used of God. But it's Ezra who's the first individual to come back with that desire and that conviction that there's something that needs to be remedied. And the Lord has stirred his heart with that desire. And God's people have to realize there's things that have to be put right. And if revival comes, there'll be a putting of them right. That's the mark of revival. Revival is not a work done only in the unsaved. In fact, maybe we could strictly say it's not done in the unsaved, because the unsaved need regeneration, not revival. You can't revive that which is dead. You might revive the fire, but there's burning coals there. There's burning coals. There's some life in the fire if you revive it up. And let the draft in and so on. Put more fuel on it and it'll soon get fanned up and it'll start to burn again. But there was life there. You can't start from a dead fire and say, oh, put on the draft and put on the fuel. It's going to light up. It's going to be revived. That won't happen. And strictly speaking, revival is a work done among God's people. The consequence then is that people are saved. The ungodly are brought to Christ. But there's a repairing of the desolations of God's house, the worship. And we're going to think a little bit about that too in Timothy, when we work our way through what Paul has to say to Timothy and what he charged him with doing. But there's much that passes for worship today, and it's anything but scriptural. Anything but scriptural. There's something else that is here as well I want you to notice. There's mention made of the wall, to give us a wall in Judah and in Jerusalem. Now, this can't be referring to the physical walls of the city, because they weren't repaired for another 13 years, to the days of Nehemiah. So it's easy, I think, to come to the conclusion. What Ezra is speaking about here is not physical walls. He's not referring to the building up of the walls, because where would you build the walls in Judah? Is that a reference to all the walled cities of Judah? Or is it a reference to a line of demarcation between the people of God and those that are mentioned there at the beginning of this chapter? Is that what Ezra had hoped for? Is that why he's so broken in heart now, when he hears that what he thought was happening, this line of demarcation between the world and the church, if we want to use those terms that will apply to us, has not been established in the manner that he had thought and that he had hoped for? And that as the news is brought to him here at the start of this chapter as to what is happening and how the princes and the rulers are having a chief part in this, it breaks his heart. When you read there of what he did in verse 3, I rent my garment and my mantle and plucked off the hair of my head and of my beard and sat down astonished. Why did he act in the fashion that he did? Was he not aware of this before he came back? Did he not know this when he came back? Or was it the fact that he had understood that there was this line of demarcation developing that is mentioned by him here in verse 9, in those words, to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem? And now he's discovering it's not been carried on as I had hoped and as I had thought. Is that what is breaking his heart and causing him even to pluck off the hair of his face and from his head and from his beard? This man is in consternation at what is happening. And yet, as I read it, did he not see this? Was he not aware of this as he come back? Is this not something of what he understood when he came back anyway, that there was things that needed to be sorted out? So why is he so perplexed? I think it's a reasonable conclusion to come to say it's because this line of demarcation is not as he had hoped it to be. And the cause of revival, or the need for revival rather, in our own times, employs all the same features. The line of demarcation between the world and the church tonight is not what it once was and not what it ought to be. We have to be honest and say that and face up to it. If we're going to see revival, we'll come to think a little more of honesty on Ezra's part here maybe another time. But for now, if we want to see this little reviving, if we want to say, Lord, just this, give us a little space of reviving in Newton Abbey or in Ulster or in the Free Church again, or just among your people generally in this land, in Ireland, well, we have to acknowledge why we need revival. Have to acknowledge why we need it. Why do we need it? It's because the line of demarcation, the wall that should be there, the wall of separation that ought to be there, is not as it ought to be and not as it once was. And some of you go back a few years before me and my time in the Free Church, so you have heard it. You've heard it before. You've heard it, other men, older men, saying it. And surely that is something we have to face up to. I remember being told, I can't remember whether it was my father-in-law or somebody else told me, that it was always Dr. Paisley's practice, and some of you can bear this out, that when he had a three-week mission anywhere, the first week he preached to Christians. I've never sat under a three-week mission by Dr. Paisley, so I can't bear testimony to that, but some of you may have, so you can bear witness to it. But that's what I was told. The first week, wherever he went, and he was doing missions here, there, and everywhere in those earlier days, the first week he always preached to Christians, because he believed that if the people of God were right with God, well then souls would be saved thereafter. And he had a set of messages that he preached. It was like a wee series that he preached at every mission virtually, the same type of message in those first night weeks of the mission, in order to see a stirring among God's people. And many, many indeed were stirred. Many put things right with God and testified thereafter that the preaching was with power and blessing to their heart, and many of them got right with God and acknowledged that they needed a reviving of heart as God's people. And then he started to preach directly to the unconverted. And Dr. Paisley had the unique skill of preaching both to believers and the unsaved in a one message. Mr. Cook used to talk about it as a double-barreled message in college when he was teaching us how to preach. He would call it a double-barreled message. Well, there's nobody more skilled at double-barreled message than Dr. Paisley, as many of you know. But that was his pattern that he followed. And if there was a stirring and a quickening and a reviving, then he knew there's going to be conversion that will follow this. Unsaved will be converted. These people stirred up will go out and bring in their family and friends and neighbours. Bring them into the meetings then. And that was his pattern that he followed. And there were times of blessing. It wasn't Dr. Paisley. The earliest mission that I remember in my Christian experience that really made an impact was one, it must be 1983. I would just have been into high school at the time. And it was William McRae, Dr. William McRae, that did it, and Fred Greenfield. Dr. McCrae was to do it all, and then he got elected in Mid-Ulster to Parliament. And therefore then Fred Greenfield and him shared it. And I remember that mission. As there were others, I was speaking to somebody the other day, we were talking about Aunt McCloy Church, and I was Reverend Thomas Martin at the minister's prayer meeting, because his wife was down testifying there. And I said, I remember that starting. I remember Clare Valley Church session deciding we're going to have a mission in Aunt McCloy and in Ballygolly, and we're going to see which one goes the best in order to start a church. And I don't know where that fitted in around it all, because that was during Mr. Allen's time, those years. But I remember that mission in 1983. I think there were 23 souls saved out of it, if my memory serves me right. 23 souls. I remember there was a young fella, his name was George. We went to school. He was a year above me in school, but we used to sit beside each other in the bus going up from Aher to Five Mile Town. Remember one day we were talking about going up the road, going to talk about the mission. We got past Clare Valley Church, as you know it, on the main road. And I remember I was talking about the mission. He wasn't saved. And remember he said to me, he says, "See that preacher?" This is his words to me. "See that preacher? He would scare you into getting saved." That's how he described it. Sadly, that lad never come to the Lord. And tonight he lives down there in the Clare Valley still, as far as I know. He never came to the Lord. But that's what he said. He says, that preacher would scare you into getting saved. Those meetings were meetings of power. Real power. Ivan Wells, I'm trying to think here as I'm talking to you, because Ivan Wells got saved at that mission. And his wife-to-be, they weren't married at that time, as far as I remember, but the two of them got saved. And they were real trophies of grace, because he told himself in his testimony, if you've ever heard it, that he ran the three places of sin in was it Castle Caulfield that he lived in, which was the pub and the bookies and the cinema, I think. He ran all three of them, and the Lord saved him. And his wife-to-be as well in that mission. I think it was 23 souls that were saved. Those days are long gone. But can they come back again? Well, why not? Why not? Yeah, we can think back to the past and I'm thankful for what the Lord did. And you can think about other missions. And there was, some of you remember back to the mission in Mossley, Orange Hall, Mr. Cranston's early days and those that were saved. And there's a few details in the history book about that. That's well worth going back and reading up on. And the number that were saved in that mission. Can that come back again? Well, can God not give a little reviving? Give us a little foothold again in Newton Abbey? Give us a hold on people? Why can he not? He's still the same God. He can send us revival. And may he do so. May the Lord bless his word tonight.